Hello, I'm Sam Clement, and welcome to The Love of Cinema, a Picture House podcast. This is our August edition. Welcome to August. On this episode of the podcast, we won't be talking about every film coming out in August. There's too many, and we don't have enough time. But we have picked just three to talk about with our guest film critics, who I'll introduce in a moment. And yeah, it's a good range of films. Something at the beginning of the month, something at the middle, something at the end. That's just the cream of the crop that the Picture House programmers at this end have asked that we cover. And I fully agree. I've actually been lucky enough to see all of the films we'll be covering this month. And I'm a big fan of all of them. But you're not here to listen to me talk about them. We have the assistants, the guest hosting assistants of two fantastic film critics, two people I'm huge fans of, and people I've been lucky enough to work with previously. So for our film reviews this month, you'll be guided through our film releases by film critics Beth Webb and Karina Antrobus. Long-term listeners to the podcast will recognize Karina's voice and Karina's name. She was my guest host for a number of years while she worked at Picture House. We worked on some fantastic projects together, and the podcast was probably my favourite thing. Every couple of weeks we'd get together, talk about the latest releases. So nice to have Karina back. And Beth Webb, well, where do you start with Beth Webb? Swindon's Reckoning, if you're a fan of The Empire or Pilot TV's podcasts, and a great film writer as well. You may recognise her name from our very own magazine, Picture House Recommends. Speaking of which, there's a brand new issue in cinemas right now. It's got Wes Anderson's The French Dispatch on the cover, and lots of great reviews and interviews inside. We've got an exclusive interview with Helen Mirren and Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson about the new Bond film. Helen Mirren wasn't talking about Bond, that's something else. But I was, you know, pretty big names. I was quite starstruck there. And Beth Webb, equally starstruck by Beth Webb, who's one of our great writers, also a contributing editor to Empire Magazine, as well as a podcast guest there. So we've got Karina and Beth. Outside their film writing work, Karina and Beth actually co-run the Bechdel Test Fest, which is a fantastic organisation that supports female-led movies with great female characters and also films with women behind the camera in the production as well. So they've got so many strings to their bow with the Bechdel Test Fest hat on. They do live in-cinema events, discussions, panels, programming. They also have a great podcast called Who Is She?, where they shine the spotlight on a particular female creative and talk about their body of work with the whole Bechdel Test gang. So do highly recommend that after you've listened to this podcast, of course. Really excited to hand over now to Karina and Beth, who will talk about this month's releases. First up, we've got a great movie called Censor. It's in cinemas on the 20th of August. It had its world premiere at Sundance Film Festival in January over in America, and it's just had its UK premiere at Sundance London, the British spin-off of the Sundance Film Festival. It's written and directed by Prano Bailey Bond, stars Neve Algar. And that's enough for me. After the review by Karina and Beth, we've got a special interview with star of the film, Neve Algar. So we'll have Karina and Beth talking about the film, and then it'll cut back to me talking to Neve about her role in the film, where she plays the lead character, Enid. Without further ado, over to Karina and Beth. The first voice you'll hear is Beth Webb.
All right, Karina, let's get started. So we're talking first of all about Censor, which is Prano Bailey Bond's directorial debut. It's set against the moral panic of like Thatcher's Britain. And it's about a young woman who thinks that she sees her deceased sister in a video nasty that she is having to regulate for work. How do I want to say regulate? She regulates for work, basically.
Yeah, she watches video nasties for a career to make sure that the wider public don't get influenced by the bad, evil nasties that would possibly make them go out and kill everyone.
Exactly.
Great job. It's a great job. I will definitely do that job. No, I mean, I found this film really, really fascinating. I've been a big fan of Prano Bailey Bond for quite some time. In fact, even I think we at Bechdel Test Fest screened one of her shorts, or she was on one of our panels. I mean, we've been doing this a long time, I forget everything, but she's one of our great British talents, and I'm really excited to see her finally do a big long feature. Well, it's not even long, it's under 90 minutes, which also makes me a fan of hers. So I must admit, I'm not very good at horror, so
no, big scary cat.
you know me. I was just like, okay, I'll go and see it. you know, love of culture and all that. And I did have, I was a bit squeamish, obviously, but I was pleasantly surprised with how engrossing it was and how beautifully shot and lit and performed it all was. And I think because of the actual quality of everything, it just kind of distracted me about how scared I was, but either way. But the concept itself is fascinating to me, and I don't know about you, but when I was at university, I was studying violence in the media and video nasties, and I still remember that kind of era of moral panic that swept over England at the idea that all these horror films were potentially influencing our young brains, and just how bizarre of a concept that was. And I like the little comedy nudges that are in here to this utopian ideal that if censorship was doing the job it should be doing, then there wouldn't be any crime and everything's okay. You know, that depth is in there. And I think that's what made it really satisfying for me.
Yeah, the political landscape it's setting just added an extra layer to me, to a film that I already felt had plenty to say. I mean, yes, I am. I stand with you as a scaredy cat. So yeah, it does have one of my favorite on-screen deaths of this year. So I think it delivers in terms of, especially like surreal horror as well, and body horror is really interesting. But I really am enjoying seeing this insurgence of women in horror who are using the genre to explore, not even necessarily gendered experiences, but experiences like grief and guilt and loss. You know, we profiled Natalie Erica James, who did an amazing film called Relic, which looked into dementia recently, and I think this is such an interesting time for women in horror, and this is definitely an extension of that, but it also isn't afraid to have a little bit of fun with it as well, which is good.
I think what was really great about it was the lead performance by Neve Alger in particular. And from listening to Pranabredo Bron talk about the casting process, she was really engrossed with her ability to lead all the way, but always have this element of censorship around her own persona, and how much she was able to carry that as part of the themes of the film. And also just kind of going back to the look and feel, and I thought that was really, really, really beautiful. You know, pinks and horrors, and pinks and purples aren't necessarily the usual landscape for your horror films, but I know that Anika Summerson was the cinematographer, and she also did Mowgli Mowgli. So once I saw those connections, I was like, oh, I can see a really lovely theme here on that palette and how that could transform to psychological horror. So it was very beautifully shot, and also really got that 80s sketchy retro feel exactly right.
I think we can both safely say that we're big fans. Despite our squeamishness, we were prepared to go ahead, and we came out fully satisfied, I would say.
Oh, 100%. I'm very excited to see where she goes next.
Yeah, big time. I will continue going to the cinema to see horror as long as it's Prano Bailey Bond making it.
I guess because of, you know, current situation and the way Censor premiered at Sundance Online this year, actually having the theatrical rollout 6 months later, it must be sort of a bit different to how things usually happen. Normally, big red carpet, cinema screenings, and then people do the home viewing thing a lot later on in a film's life.
Yeah, and I suppose that a lot of places now are doing kind of day per day and in the cinema, but also, like, I know that Black Widow did that with Disney. And so I suppose it, like, there is good and bad. It means that, you know, viewing films, and especially independent films, becomes more accessible. And so it broadens the audience for it. So, like I said, like, this is a movie that I feel was made for the cinema. Anika Summerson, our DOP, has created this, you know, it was shot on 35mm, and come on, you want to see a movie that's shot in film in the cinema.
I was wondering, with Prano, this is her first sort of feature length movie. What was your, how did you get involved? How did you first talk to Prano, and what was that conversation like?
So the casting came in, and I was asked to self-tape, and I saw that Prano's name was on, obviously attached to direct, and I was like, I know that name. And we'd actually met about 8 months previous at the Screen International Screen Stars of Tomorrow event. Both of us were selected in the same year, and we ended up sitting beside each other at this event. Michael Shannon was at the same event. He was as a guest, and everyone was sat at Michael's table, and then me and Prano Prana was stuck with me, unfortunately. So I was just fascinated by just her knowledge of the film industry. She's coming at it with an extensive knowledge of writing, editing, from an actor's point of view. I always think that this doesn't feel like a first time feature film. It just so happens to be her debut feature. It's interesting because someone said to me, was like, how would you describe this movie? And I was like, it's a Prana Bailey Bond movie. It has its own original signature stamp. And if you don't know what that means, I think just watch it and you will know. She has such a unique eye on storytelling and creating character that you haven't seen done before. And I think that what's so interesting about Enid is that this is a very unique perspective of a character who's going on this psychological journey and using the medium of genre. And for her, like, Prana is obviously a huge genre fan, and this is a total love letter to that. And so for me, working on a film with Prana, especially, she's just so passionate. And when you see someone who is that passionate, you can't help that passion is so, it's so infectious. And so being in that environment with her, like this crew that she had assembled, it was amazing. I wish I could go back and do it again. She probably wouldn't say that. She'd be like, it took long enough to bloody make me calm down. Yeah.
Sounds like you formed a really great partnership with Prana and the, you know, the rest of the crew.
Yes. No, we did. Like I said to her, so it was like, you're not going to talk to me now because you go into the edit. I always find that like directors, you can't help but form a strong bond with people that you trust. You have to like build this level of trust with a director and with other cast, because you're on something like this that is so emotionally driven. You're preparing to go to a quite an emotional place for it with your character, and to do that in, you know, surrounded by other people, that they have to make you feel safe. And so by doing that, it's just forming bonds. And myself and Prana naturally formed this bond, and I consider a really good friend of mine. And I'm very lucky that I'm in a profession that forces people to form bonds.
I've spoken to Prana a few weeks ago, and she loves horror. It was really infectious. Did Prana give you any homework, make you watch any films before going into this?
Yeah, there was a Dropbox file that she kept on adding to, and it was like my homework. I was away filming in Cape Town at the time, and so I'd like log into the Dropbox and there'd be like 20 more movies that were added. The piano teacher was one, more from tonally from a character, and Black Swan also from that idea of that there's just a psychological journey that the character goes on and the blurred lines between reality and fiction. But also like on the horror side of it, we were looking at a horror called Let's Scare Jessica to Death, and she wanted me to watch, but there was also from the video nasty world of some of the movies that Enid would have been watching during when we were filming. Cannibal Holocaust was one. It was like scene specific that we kind of plucked out and used so that we had something to actually react to. And if not, we could reference it. So there was all like, she thought of everything. There was no, what I loved about it is that the confidence that you have in a director who has explored every kind of possible detail in the story and in the character. And when you do that, you can just trust them and take the direction as the God's words.
Thank you very much, Niamh Algar. Fun fact, Niamh Algar, just before recording that interview, watched Black Widow at Picture House Central. Speaking of censor, before we get to our next film, at Picture House, we have programmed a fantastic season of horror films directed by women called A Terrifying Uprising. It starts on the 13th of August with a preview of Censor, the film that we just talked about, and carries on throughout August and into September, showing some modern classics and some just genuine out-and-out classics. We've got St. Maud, which we didn't actually get to play because of the pandemic. Our cinemas were closed when that film opened, directed by Rose Glass, an incredible film. We've also got Raw by Julia Ducournau, and we've got The Babadook by Jennifer Kent, and we go all the way back to the original Pet Sematary, the 1989 Pet Sematary. So check out that season. More listings available at your local Picture House or on picturehouses.com/uprising. And that's enough of my plug. Let's have another film. Let's talk about Sean Durkin's new film. Beth and Karina will come back now to talk about the movie, and stick around because Jude Law joins me after their review to talk about working on the movie with Sean Durkin.
So next up, we have The Nest. Now, I was a really big fan of this, and the more I think about it, the more I unpick and really love it. But so this was it's an irresistible psychological drama about a marriage on the turn. And again, we're back in the 80s in both New York and London, which looks very suburban London. But Jude Law, he's an eager investment banker who insists on relocating his family from New York to a huge London manor to chase yet another big gamble. You can tell that his family are very exhausted by his big dreams. But this is where things go sour. And I really enjoyed this character study of this marriage, which was built on all these dreams that weren't actually coming to amounting to anything. And I really loved Jude Law in this, and I didn't realize how much I really enjoyed Jude Law until I watched this. Like, you know what? This is a great performance, probably one of his best, and it's a real amalgamation of all his previous roles of, you know, that Don Draper type slimy boyfriend your mum told you not to bring home type person. But I found him very magnetic.
Yeah, exactly. I think this was, as I was watching it, I was like, oh, this is such a good role for him, because it allows him to really funnel that charisma and as you say, this kind of slippery charm to him, this kind of honey-tongued wealthy kind of ideal of a man who really underneath it is deeply troubled and quite quickly falling apart. I really love the director of this film. He made a film called Martha. I never get it the right order. Martha, Marcy, yeah. May, Marlene.
Yeah, say that after a shandy.
So it's Sean Durkin.
Yes.
And I really enjoy his... I mean, the films that he makes aren't uplifting films, but they're stunning in their commentary of kind of power dynamics. And this film is really delicious. And special shout out to Carrie Coon as well, who I loved in The Leftovers, and gets to really undermine Jude Law's character in very public, very scandalous ways.
Yeah, the dinner scenes are particularly excellent. She absolutely steals the scene in the way that she smokes, bangs her forks on the table. And I think in the wrong hands and the wrong director, her role could be somebody that was undermined or taken advantage of or manipulated, but she has a real strength within her character as the wife. She's not just a wife. She's us. We're looking through the eyes of her, looking at this man who is just caving in on himself. But I also think that even though Jude Law is this kind of despisable character, you always are rooting for him somehow. You're always wanting...
Are you?
I was like, mainly because I didn't want the family to collapse, because this poor family was just like, what the hell is he doing next? You know? I just thought the settings were really, really, really brilliant, just to kind of see this contrast between New York and the UK, should I say. It didn't put us in the best light, but, you know, this is a very good commentary on 18s Britain and how we were on that brink of wealth and how irresponsible people were with where the wealth came from and how unethical it all was. And I just think this is a really interesting character study as to what happens when underlying issues that happen within that era.
Yeah, I think so. And he's, it's funny to see how Jude Law's character becomes essentially a punching bag for that, and see how he is sort of chipped down part by part until what are you left with? That's sort of the question. What happens when that's all taken away? What really is going to matter at the end of the day?
Yeah, and I obviously won't give it away, but the last scene I just think sums it up nicely. Just that one perfect shot at the end.
Yes, definitely.
I'll say no more. But yeah, highly recommend.
It's such a gripping film. Was it like that for you when you first heard about the project? And I don't know if you read a script or if it was a conversation at the beginning of this.
It was a script, and I was excited to read it because I was intrigued to know what Sean Durkin was doing next. The two pieces I'd seen of his I'd really liked. He's someone who's meticulous and patient. And as with all of us, it was like, well, how's he following these up and what's he been up to? And I loved it from the get-go. I loved the dynamic of the family. I loved the shifts in power between the husband and wife. I loved the complicit nature of the relationship. I loved that it wasn't reliant on you know, someone's death or someone's the divorce of someone. I love that it got into domestic drama without using any of those sort of rather more immediate devices or obvious devices. I didn't like Rory. I didn't like the character I'd been asked to play. And that worried me because I really wanted to do it. And I think what I was seeing was, it was clear to me that he needed warming up. It was clear to me that we had to work out what it was that was seductive about him. When he was stripped down and on the page, you saw the manipulation and you saw the lies a little more clearly. And what was important to me was that, first of all, you understood that he was a good man trying to do the right thing, just the wrong way. But also that there was this salesman quality that I had to sort of bring from somewhere. I kept thinking of Robert Redford in the sort of late 70s with that wonderful hair. And you know, he looked the part, Redford, always. And I kept thinking, God, what would Redford do with this, you know, when he was in his like late 30s, early 40s? And with that in mind, we sort of polished it a little bit. But that was also the challenge. I quite like taking on things where I think, this is tricky. Why is it going to work? Not the piece, the part. It was clear from the get-go that the piece was going to work. I underestimated Sean's confidence in nuance. It was very interesting that the piece was more explicit, and used also this interesting device of it being a kind of ghost story without ghosts, that the house is a character in the film and the sort of haunting of the house is almost Rory's fake, Rory's energy, you know? And then as we made it and as I then saw cuts of it, it was clear that he really is a master filmmaker, and his confidence in nuance, his confidence in the tiniest gesture and brushstroke of storytelling was enough. And I think that's why it's quite an impactful film. At times you're sitting there gripped, like you say, and yet you don't necessarily know, well, when's the big twist or when's the... And in fact, it doesn't really come, but it nonetheless leaves you sort of moved. And I think there's a familiarity too to the way people behave in it that I think really hits people. And they come away often saying, God, that reminded me of my mother, or that was just like my father, or I've been in that environment. And that's quite an impact for an audience.
I think you're right. It really gets under your skin. And you know, maybe not for the exact reasons that the characters in the film are going through. You'd have to live quite an exciting life, I think, for that to happen. But yeah. but you see bits of yourself. It made me feel quite anxious. I love going to the cinema to be moved, you know, whether I'm laughing, crying, you know, that sort of feeling you get in your gut, which you really get when you're immersed in a film. And I was so immersed in this, got under my skin and stayed with me. I imagine living in the film like you have, it must have been a sort of a much more heightened experience of that.
It was a very happy experience because, you know, it's for me always a pleasure to be in the company of really great fellow filmmakers, whether it's the DP, whether it's the design, whether it's the wardrobe and hair and makeup, but certainly with the actors and the family around me. Carrie and Charlie and Una were really brilliant. We bonded very quickly and enjoyed the work together very quickly. And what was interesting, and there was also something very cathartic about playing Rory, you know, playing someone on that kind of high energy, that kind of high enthusiasm, can be exhausting, but weirdly, as an actor, when you get to kind of peel away and get into the darker and slightly more complicated layers, there can be something of a purge in it, and you get to vent a lot of that. So I remember finishing it feeling very satisfied, just wanting a bit more. I wish I could have carried on for a couple more weeks, but it was a short, sweet experience.
It's always good to leave them wanting more. That must be a good kind of showbiz thing to say.
Doesn't always happen either, let me tell you.
I was really struck by I love your relationship with Carrie in the film. I think you're so good together. There's a great scene where it's just the two of you, where things are sort of kicking off in a library or sort of room in the house. It's one of the most intense sort of coupled relationships I think I've ever seen on the screen. I wonder how you prepare for, you know, quite an intense scene with a scene partner like Carrie.
So we shot the film almost entirely in order, which was a blessing, and again, overseen by Sean, who knew that would have an impact. We'd done a little bit of prep together, Carrie and I. We met, if I remember, she was in New York working, so Sean and I went to see her before we filmed, and we spent an afternoon just discussing how the couple met, and we wanted to make sure that we both had a very familiar sense of where they'd come from and how they'd built this family. And then obviously we talked a lot about the work and the scenes. But like me, Carrie's done a lot of theatre work. And I think we were both excited that Sean wanted to shoot a lot of these scenes in their entirety. And Mateus, the DP, is a sort of master of that. He's able to find shapes for the camera, dance moves almost for the camera that enable you as an actor to play the whole thing through. And he's also there able to capture and steer the audience so that they're in the right place at the right time. Now, that sometimes means they're playing to the back of your head. You, the actor, therefore, you know, you're aware that that's how to convey the story. But that was a very good scene to give an example of this. We just ran it. We didn't have huge amounts of time, but I remember that scene, I think we spent most of the day. We worked on it so that we knew that every detail was spot on. And then we were able to just run it and run it and run it and film it in one over and over and over again. And sadly, it comes at this moment where, you know, the veil is being sort of pulled from between them and the truths are coming out. And as I said before, at its heart, it's a film about the complicit nature of a relationship. So they're both equally able to say, you know, this is me, or don't react like that. I know that, you know, you're as guilty of this as I am. And it often leaves the other party in the relationship without a leg to stand on.
If you got to say something to an audience who are just about to see the film, what would you say to them?
Well, first of all, I'm thrilled that it's being shown on the big screen. I'm very happy to be in the hands of Picture House, and I feel like we fit the Picture House curation really, really well. So I'm very proud to be a part of that, because I've seen a lot of films that I've admired and enjoyed at Picture House, and to be a part of their family is a big deal for me. I think I would say to an audience watching this, watch it with an open heart and don't judge.
So that was Dynast. Dynast opens in cinemas on the 27th of August. As I mentioned in an interview with Jude there, thank you very much to Jude Law, star of The Holiday and the talented Mr. Ripley, and now Dynast joining us on our podcast. Okay, we're on to our final film now. We've got, now this film also played at the very Sundance heavy month this month. All of the films we've talked about played at the Sundance Film Festival either in 2020 or 2021, and all of them recently played at Sundance London. So lots of great indie movies. We're celebrating independent cinema here, always nice to do. And this next film is in cinemas right now. It's called Zola. It's directed by Janixa Bravo, and Karina and Beth will talk about the film. And like the previous two films, we're joined by a special guest after the interview. Director Janixa Bravo talks to Karina Antrobus about making the film. Zola is in cinemas now. Enjoy.
Last but not least, I think we've struck lucky with these, because we're ending with Zola, which is a film based on a Twitter thread, a completely unique concept at this stage. Maybe it won't be the last film we see based on the Twitter thread, we'll wait to see. But this is about a stripper who goes by the stage name Zola, played by Taylor Page in the film. And she's so good. But she starts the journey as a Detroit waitress, and then she embarks on this road trip to Florida with Stefani, who's played by Riley Q in the film. And it's a trip gone wrong, basically. Riley Q's pimp shows up and turns out to be an incredibly violent and volatile character. We've got her boyfriend, played by Succession's Nicholas Braun in this, who is essentially channels that same sort of daftness, but with a terrible beard. It's a very contained film because it is based on a tweet thread. That's where the story lies. But what stood out for me with this was the two performances, Taylor Page and Riley Q. It's a really athletic film. Like, there's a lot of women wearing very, very, very little clothes, working for money. But I also think it's tricky because it's one of those A24 films with very much an A24 aesthetic. You know, you've got the sunset hues and the neon and the kind of cash grab aesthetic. But this is a film about trauma. Like, something very traumatizing happens to these two women. And it deals with the transaction of sex work in a really interesting way that I really liked. But essentially, I think it's these two performances that stand out for me. And this is no small feat of the director. What horrifies me is that this was originally going to be directed by James Franco. This was going to be a James Franco film. And,
Oh, wow. Praise be. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So he left the project. And then we had this new fantastic director come in who... featuring on the podcast today, and we'll hear more about that. But she I think drew out these incredible performances from the two cast, and that made that a real takeaway for me.
Yeah, I mean, on paper this film shouldn't work. It's a film based on a tweet thread at a time when threads weren't even a thing. You had to do each individual Twitter. Do you remember when Twitter didn't actually allow you to thread your tweets?
Yeah.
So that in itself is a feat. But I think, considering how hit and miss it can be to make films about social media and its uses, this actually is probably up there with one of the most interesting, creative, electrifying ones of really looking at how social media has, and storytelling has gone from one platform to the next, and that artistic creative direction of what we've left with here. And I think the performances are brilliant, really interesting, absolutely contained in this, what is it like a 24, one weekend, 24 hours, but you know, this set amount of time, so much happens. And yeah, I just think it's really, I mean, not everything that happened in real life is actually in the film, which is crazy in itself, because it's just like, wow, there's actually a darker side to this story. So as much as I think we're all having a bit of a titter about it, I think you're absolutely right to just consider that these are lives that have happened, and these are traumatic experiences that have been inflicted upon these women. And I think we should take that away with it as well, and just be like, well, this is a reality for some people.
The casting is just superb. And on stage yesterday in your Q&A, you something struck me. You said that you saw, is it 700 girls to get Zola?
It's actually, the number's actually closer to 800, but wow. Over 700 sounds better.
Sure. I mean,
the writing, right? Like, the writing of over 700 sounds better than like close to 800. You know, I just,
sure,
like,
sure.
I like that writing better.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, at what point were you, again, you must have got to like, I don't know, 355 and be like, oh, screw it, I'll do it. But I mean, Taylor Page is divine. And talk to me about that moment when you saw her and was like, there we go, found her.
Again, I thought, well, we'll know when we know. And I didn't keep track of the number, because I think if I had known the number while we were in it, I would have felt a bit more hopeless. And so I had a sense it was a lot, and it really wasn't until I saw Taylor that I was like, how many girls have we met? And I have the number somewhere. It's like 822, I believe. It's something like that. Yeah. And I was like, that's insane. but also that's my, the casting director and I, right? Like, the producers are not shown all of this, because sometimes people weren't worth them seeing, right? It's like, and we'd gone after a lot of non-actors. I was also seeking, I've been open to non-actors. That's why the number's so inflated. Scouring Instagram, scouring Facebook, you know, finding someone's profile that looked great, or they took good photos, or they seemed to be really kind of like wild in a certain way and really youthful, and sent to my casting director, and then her going on a hunt to find them and trying to get them to tape. And anyways, but Taylor was just it. I saw her in LA on the street. She walked into this coffee shop and I just was like, oh yeah, that's her. And I took a photo of her to send to my casting director, because I knew she was an actress, but I didn't know what she was in. But I was like, this girl, I know she's an actress. Mm-hmm. I know it. I can't tell, I don't know why, but I know she's been on television or something. And so I take a photo of her, and she sees me take the photo, and she is not happy. She shouldn't be, by the way. She's not happy. And yeah. And then I send it to my casting director, and the casting director's like, oh, Taylor Page. And there we are.
She's fantastic. She's definitely worth the wait, I'm sure. Another thing that got tongues wagging yesterday was your own personal dazzling style up on stage. Everyone was just like, wow, she looks so good. But I wondered, in the film, the costumes, the outfits are just amazing. How much input did you have in that, from the outfits, even to the pants that that Derek's wearing are just like spot on?
I used to be a stylist. That's in right. my background. And I don't know how other directors work. When I used to be a stylist, I'd worked for a handful of directors who were not so involved in the clothing. Mm-hmm. And that is to say they knew what they liked or they knew what they didn't like, right? That was kind of how we went about costuming. My parents are both tailors. So if you look at Zola and look at all of my work, it is clear that costume design is part of my story. And that is not to take away from our costume designer, but our costume designer had never done work like this. There were certain pieces that I really wanted that I knew existed. I also had been following younger designers and, you know, I had really liked Emily Bodie's work, and Coleman's wearing a Bodie top towards the bottom of half of the film. And I think the line had been out a couple of years and I just thought we should get Bodie in here. I know the pieces are vintage. She only makes like five, but we're gonna ask her for one. And we got one. And there was Adam Selman's pink flamingo see-through pants that Riley was wearing. I also just actually wanted them for myself and I wanted to see them and was just like, but maybe she'll wear them. And then we got them and we got them to give them to us. Right. Nice. Also the girls are quite petite. So you can also like borrow samples from people because they can fit in them. And I worked in fashion. So clothing really matters to me. Clothing really matters as a part of my storytelling. And I think that's pretty clear in the film.
One of the interesting things when researching the film, even before it came out, and the reporting on this particular story in the Twitter thread for me was reading about how it was reported in this kind of scandalous way, like who's telling the truth, what really went down. And I think that was kind of at the expense of reporting about how these girls' well-being was, or their safety, or the actual care of their own personal backstory. And I just feel like, in the wrong hands, this film could have been very salacious, but you've taken a lot of care to make sure that there's a lot of dynamics to all of their relationships with their work and themselves. Talk to us about that process of making sure that you're not flattening anyone, and how much you wanted to ensure that there was a respect for them as women and their careers and their chosen paths.
But, you know, that's the real Zola. Not that I don't want to credit myself, but that is her. That's what she did, right? So I was what she wrote. And what I thought was super remarkable about the piece was that there wasn't any judgment about the work. What she is judging is having been brought into a situation where there had been no transparency, and having been brought into a situation where her agency was being taken care of her. That's when she starts judging it. She is not judging the sex work. She is not judging... she's not even really judging trafficking. She's just saying like, y'all didn't tell me the rules of the game. And had I been told, I wouldn't have participated. And I had never met that character. I never met this person. I had never seen sex work in this way. And I think that if the reason I write for the film is because of the humor, right? And I think that like, that's a sweet spot that really makes sense to me. And it is where is the balance of the sweet and the sour, so to speak. I just did what she told me to do, basically. I really just respected the thread so deeply. I treated it as I would a great piece of theater. And that is to say, I am a theater kid. So were I to adapt Chekhov, Ibsen, you know, Pinter, there'd be certain rules about how you go about adapting. And so here, I just really respected the text and did what she did, which was, I feel, present in this way. Also, independent of that, I wouldn't be able to make something where I was judging the characters. I kind of have to see myself in all of the characters in some way. I have to understand the choices they're making, whether or not I agree with them. Mm-hmm. And so I wouldn't have made it if the colors were not like that.
Cinemas are open again, which is fabulous news. Beth, what is still in the cinema that you absolutely think that people should go and watch?
Okay, well, I'm going to use my platform for good and promote like a smaller film that I don't think will be on many people's radars. It's a film called Riders of Justice. Corrida, are you a Mads Mikkelsen fan?
I am, big time. Yes.
Well, this is Beardy Mads Mikkelsen on a revenge rampage after his... So he's been deployed, but he has to come back because his wife dies under mysterious circumstances. And he goes on this like quest for revenge while trying to hold things together with his teenage daughter. It's got a real air of the Coen brothers to it. If you're craving a little bit of Coen-esque dark humour and violence, that's really great. And yeah, Mads Mikkelsen in a beard on full rampage form. Like, he can do no wrong in my eyes. And this is just another... kind of chapter in the argument as to why he's one of the best guys alive, basically.
Oh, I'm sold, absolutely. well, my recommendation, and it's, sorry if it's an obvious one, but I still think Summer of Soul is a fantastic, fantastic documentary. The incredible use of archive footage, and I still can't get over the fact that if this archive footage wasn't found, we wouldn't know about this festival that happened in Harlem over the course of 6 weeks, and how important it is to look at the alternatives to what we're told about. So everybody's heard about Woodstock, but who's heard of the Harlem Music Festival? Not many people until now. And in the to get that footage of the likes of Sly and the Family Stone, Stevie Wonder, Nina Simone, and put it in the hands of Questlove, what a dream. And I think, you know, it's been a rough couple of years, and this is just the most uplifting film that I've seen in so long, and it just makes my heart sing. And yeah, I'm just glad it's still around, and the longer it's in the cinemas the better, because it's a tonic, absolute tonic.
All right, so that's two vastly different films, but you know, I think both scratching an itch that needs to be scratched, to be honest. And then for you, what is coming up? I can't believe we're halfway through this year already, but what is coming up in the tail half of this wretched year that you are really looking forward to?
Well, I am fresh from watching the House of Gucci trailer, which has just dropped, and OMG, it looks amazing.
It
looks mad, but in the way that you pick up a Vogue magazine and you're just like, who wears this? Who affords this? This is ridiculous, but oh my God, I love it. Like, that's just how I felt about it. I mean, Lady Gaga, Adam Driver, absolutely looking ridiculously beautiful. So Sarah Gay Forden wrote the book, and it's really interesting to see that now come to this just dripping in opulence film, which I'm just going to absolutely want to lick the screen for.
Oh my God, the bit when, in the trailer when Lady Gaga goes, the father, the son, and the house of Gucci. I mean, my soul like left my body. It was exactly. Incredible. Yeah. Speaking of souls leaving bodies, I am very excited for The Green Knight coming out. Who's to
you
say
and the rest of the world?
This is so frustrating to see all these glowing reviews, but I think Dev Patel is at such an interesting phase in his career. He's moving into directing now, which I'm really excited for, considering he was this skinny little noodle who used to be on Skins and now is doing extraordinary things. I'm a massive fan of David Lowery, who is the director of the film, and this feels like a step into the epic for him. And yeah, these glowing, tantalizing, infuriating reviews are just stoking my want to watch this even more. And a talking fox as well, so you can't go wrong there either.
Well, this is it. I mean, two very escapist films there, and I think that's very telling as to what we're needing right now in life.
Absolutely. Lady Gaga and talking foxes.
Beth, where can people follow you on the World Wide Web?
Twitter, I'm Beth K. Webb. And Instagram, if you fancy seeing terrible pictures of food, Beth Kate Webb. And Karina, how about yourself? And tell us a little bit more about our mission.
Yes, absolutely. So I'm at Karina Karina with a C, RR1N. Guys.
You'd be amazed.
Yeah. And then on Instagram, I'm C_bus. And together we run the Bechtel Test Fest, and we celebrate and platform the wonderful work of women in film, especially when they create work that puts women in a positive light and has wonderful representations of our complex experiences.
Films we've spoken about today, which is
Exactly. And we are at Bechtel Test Fest on all major platforms. Apart from TikTok, we haven't got there yet, but you know.
No, and we won't, to be honest.
Yeah, watch this space, but we'll see.
Well, there we go. Oh, what a packed section. So Zola, Janixa Bravo, and what Karina and Beth have been watching recently and what they're looking forward to. Some great choices there as well. I really loved working with Karina on this episode, and so nice to get Beth on the podcast for the very first time. Hopefully we'll have them back again soon. Big thank you to Karina and Beth for guest hosting, and a big thank you to our special guests. Niamh Algar, Jude Law, Janixa Bravo, people whose work I adore, and such a thrill to have them all on the podcast. Again, hopefully we'll get them back when they're doing the next film. It'd be nice to catch up. So lots of food for thought there, lots of things to see at your local picture house in August. So thank you very much for listening. If you go to the movies, let us know what you watch. You can tweet us at picturehouses, or you can email us at podcast@picturehouses.co.uk. I've been Sam Clements, and this podcast has been produced by Kobe Omanaka, edited by Maddie Searle, and the fine folks at Stripped Media. Thank you for all of your hard work and help. If you check the show notes, you can see how to get in touch with Karina and Beth. You can listen to their podcast, Who Is She?, and find out more about what they do at the Bechdel Test Fest. All of the info in the show notes. We'll be back in September with another selection of films, with another set of guest critics. Really excited about September show. We're starting to get blockbusters now. We've had this month is all about independent cinema. Come September, we've got big films. We've got Bond, we've got Shang-Chi, the new Marvel film, and a few other treats as well. If you've enjoyed the show this month, do go to your podcast repository of choice and leave us a review and a rating. A lovely 5-star review would be very nice. It helps others find the show and lets us know we're doing a good job. We read everyone's comments also, so please leave a review. It's great to hear from you. Do check the feed. It's worth subscribing if you're a first-time listener, because occasionally we'll have a bonus episode. I think we've got a couple of bonus episodes coming in August, a couple of full-length interviews with filmmakers as they're available, so always worth checking the feed. But that's it from me. We'll be back on the first Friday in September. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great time at the movies, and let us know what you're watching. Always love to hear what people are watching. Thank you for listening. See you next month. Goodbye.